Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just when you think you've got the technology industry all figured out, it goes and pulls the rug right out from under you. Yahoo named a new CEO today, and boy, it's a doozy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 16th of July. It's a Monday. Good to have you with us. Until about 1:15 or so this afternoon, Silicon Valley time, Marissa Mayer was a widely respected, highly influential, and firmly ensconced vice president at Google. At 1:16, boom, she was the new CEO of Yahoo. It is, with not really very much exaggeration at all, a huge move, both for Mayer and for Yahoo. Andrew Ross Sorkin is editor-at-large in the New York Times Deal Book blog. He's also an anchor on CNBC's Squawk Box really early in the morning. Andrew, good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So remind us who Marissa Mayer is, would you?
Well, Marissa Mayer is one of the most senior people at Google. She has been in charge of the look and feel of everything you know about Google, that famous Google homepage that you put your search terms into. She was one of the people that was very involved in the look and feel and what we think about Gmail today, mm-hmm. and Google News and Google Images and Google Maps. And so everything that we touch in many ways on Google, she has been a huge part of.
And Yahoo looked around and said, we want you. What are they hoping, do you think, that she will bring to them that they haven't been able to find in anybody else? And they really haven't, right?
Well, you know, Yahoo's really struggled, and they've struggled on multiple fronts. Really, more than anything, it's been about finding a leader with a vision and a reputation to bring people along, to be able to hire really great talent in this fierce, horrible bidding war that goes on in Silicon Valley between Google and Facebook and Yahoo. You know, Yahoo has really been the loser in all of this. And this idea that you could bring somebody in like Marissa to really try to attract new talent, to really focus on what they describe as the quote-unquote end-user experience, the way we interact with Yahoo. You know, I was speaking with David Filo today, who's the co-founder mm-hmm. of Yahoo mm-hmm. with Jerry Yang, and he was saying one of the things that just that Yahoo's lacked over all these years is with all the turnover at the top has been a focus on the way the thing looks and feels and the way you interact with it, and that's one of the reasons so many people, in his mind, have left Yahoo. And so I think that she has the opportunity potentially to bring that back to the fore, to try to bring new talent with her.
Is this a little bit, just getting back to that bidding war you mentioned, is this a little bit of addition by subtraction? Not only is Yahoo getting Marissa Mayer, a huge get, but they're also stealing her from Google.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, in the pantheon of great, you know, in this great discussion of Google versus Microsoft versus Yahoo versus Facebook, this is one for the ages. This was a surprise. You know, for the past month, we've heard many names bandied about who could take over this company. And she was never somebody you had mentioned, in part because you never thought she was really going to leave Google.
Yeah.
And so, yes, this is in many ways a big get. Now, one note of caution, I should say, she's never run a company.
Yeah.
So she's never been a CEO before. She manages a lot of people. She manages, by the way, over 1,000 people at Google. But that's very different than being the CEO of a company. I should also note she just joined the board recently of Walmart. So she does have. So she's trying to, you know, gain some corporate experience there. And as part of this, not only will she be the CEO, she'll be the president, and she's also going to join the board of Yahoo.
Yeah, this is unbelievably cynical, but two questions that I'm going to roll into one because we're almost out of time. Number one, how long does her honeymoon last? And number two, it seems like kind of a risk for Yahoo.
Well, honeymoons, I think, like this could last anywhere from 6 months to a year, which probably, frankly, is not enough time in terms of really being able to turn things around in a measurable way. Perhaps investors will give her a little bit longer than that. As to your second question,
it sounds like I've got you flummoxed a little bit.
You've got me. You do have me flummoxed. I'm not sure what the right answer is. I do think it's a risk for Yahoo, but in many respects, it's probably also a risk for her.
Good point. Andrew Ross Sorkin, he edits Deal Book at the New York Times, broke the story about Marissa Mayer going to Yahoo today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Hey, so here's a question: does she have to switch from Gmail to Yahoo Mail now? What do you think? The news came, as news like this always does, seem to come after the closing bell on Wall Street. After hours, Yahoo up about 2.25% or so. We'll have the details when we always have the details. Remember all those times you've heard me and many others say consumer spending accounts for a huge chunk of the American economy? All right, now repeat after me. Say this out loud. How can you expect me to spend when that very same American economy is still shaky? To which I say, I know, right? Retail sales figures for the month of June were announced today. Dismal is not too strong a word. The third straight monthly decline, something that hasn't happened since the darkest days of 2008. Oh, and it's not just sales that are depressed either. Marketplace's Sally Herships has that story.
Lately, it feels like the bad news always comes first.
I'm sorry for being so pessimistic, but that's how it is. This retail sales report was just a very bad report.
Chris Christopher is senior principal economist with IHS Global Insights. One reason he sounds so down is that the decline in sales started in April. And after those numbers were released, the government revised them downwards.
So things are worse than we originally thought in April as well.
In case you weren't already depressed.
Read the newspaper, listen to the news, and what do I see? Greece and Spain and all the problems there and how that impacts us as consumers.
Jim Roberts teaches marketing at Baylor University. He says it's no wonder consumers are hesitant about spending. And even though gas prices went down last month, that doesn't mean extra cash for us to spend. Robert says many of us have been paying for gas with money we didn't have.
We're still spending money on credit cards, and so the money's, I'd like to think there'd been a big uptick in savings, but there just hasn't.
Time for some less bad news. For those Americans who are financially stable, a lot of the problem could be in our heads. That's according to Barbara Kahn, director of the J.H. Baker Retailing Center at Wharton.
I mean, if you just lost your job yesterday and didn't spend money, well, that's understandable. But if nothing's really changed in your life, but your spending patterns have radically changed, why is that?
It's nerves. But Chris Christopher says, if you can, go ahead and take that vacation. Bonus, you'd be helping to boost the economy. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We tweeted out a question this morning. We wanted to know, if you're not spending money on fun retail, then what are you spending it on? One common answer, gas. You can tweet us at Marketplace APM. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl. Long after the economy comes back, and I mean really comes back now, not the false starts we've had the past couple of years, there are still going to be reminders of what happened. You can see one of the biggest already. There are tens of thousands of buildings out there that are empty, abandoned, for lack of somebody to pay the mortgage. Some cities figure they've got the easy answer. Just tear them down. Save on maintenance and upkeep and hopefully get some new development in there in their place. Of course, easy answers are never the whole answer, as Adam Ellington reports now from St. Louis Public Radio.
It's pushing 100 degrees, and I'm standing on a corner in downtown St. Louis, about to be picked up by the man who is perhaps most intimately familiar with the after effects of the city's housing crisis. This man's name is Roland Comfort, and he's the building demolition supervisor for the city of St. Louis.
How you doing?
Hi, Roland. Sorry I'm late.
Okay, you're not late by much.
From here, we head northwest. The windows rolled down because there's no air conditioning. 10 minutes later, Comfort pulls up to a two-story brick house on Labadie Avenue. The front porch has fallen off, the brick parapet is crumbling, and a sidewall has started to lean. And this, he says, is actually not that bad.
Look around. You could almost close your eyes and you could take down almost any building you see on some streets.
The city of St. Louis currently maintains some 10,000 abandoned properties. And when you factor in those that are still technically under private ownership, Comfort estimates that as many as one-third of the homes in North St. Louis are empty. And the idea that developers might take a stab at rehabbing those houses just isn't realistic for most cases.
In a day where the actual cost of rehabbing is anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000, it doesn't make a lot of sense on a street where the average sales price of occupied buildings are probably less than $40,000.
Comfort says he only takes down structures that pose a threat to public safety. But others claim the city is too quick to knock buildings down. Michael Allen is the director of the St. Louis-based Preservation Research Office. He claims that as many as half the buildings demolished in St. Louis were actually sound under the city's building code.
It's the difference between a fragile neighborhood that can be brought back and a neighborhood that is going to be so diminished that no developer in their right mind would be able to take it on.
Allen says financing for large-scale development projects isn't as available as it once was, and knocking down existing housing stock only speeds up the process of out-migration and neglect.
That's the direction neighborhoods are heading when they start getting out the wrecking ball to deal with larger social problems. There's still drug dealing, there's still unemployment, there's still poverty, there's still poor housing. You can take down every last vacant building in North St. Louis, and those are the underlying problems, and they're going to remain.
And it's not just St. Louis that's struggling with this issue. Last month, Detroit Mayor David Bing announced plans to demolish some 10,000 buildings by the end of his term.
I would say we got a few areas in the city that are just decimated.
Faced with the toxic combination of high unemployment, population loss, and a shrinking tax base, Bing says at this point the city of Detroit can't avoid making tough choices. That means channeling scarce funding into certain key areas at the expense of neighborhoods that he says are beyond fixing.
And so those areas you've got to go and demolish. But there's no way our revenue stream is going to be able to support what we supported when we had a million or 2 million people.
Still, despite the fiscal realities many cities face, others worry demolition policies are based more on politics, a chance for cities to clear the land of the urban poor and open up cheap land for developers. Alderman Sam Moore represents the historically black 4th Ward in St. Louis.
What's going to happen is they're going to take too many of them out, and then it becomes just land to divide up.
Of the 3,500 empty buildings in Moore's ward, 845, he says, are slated for demolition.
In that 845, there's a lot of our history. Chuck Berry, Robert Guillon, Tina Turner, all these people's houses are in there.
Moore says he's sympathetic to residents who complain about crime associated with vacant homes and decreasing property values on otherwise stable blocks. The problem, he says, is if he took down all the empty buildings in the 4th Ward, there wouldn't be a ward left. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Coming up, folk art in Santa Fe and where that fits in the global economy.
Women have opened their own businesses through the money they get from this market.
But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so markets resumed their losing ways today after Friday's big surge as companies continued reporting earnings better than expected, but lower than a year ago. The Dow Industrials gave up 49 points, 0.4% for the blue chips, 12,727 the number. The NASDAQ off 11 points, also 0.4, 2896. The S&P 500 shaved back 3 points, about 0.25%. 1353 is the number you're looking for there. Visa was up around 2.5% today. MasterCard nearly 2% after settling a long dispute over the fees that they charge retailers. The card companies and some banks will pay more than $7 billion to retailers, and the stores are going to be free to charge customers more for using credit cards. So if you buy your groceries with plastic, you may want to start paying cash. Two of the retailers who sued were grocery giants Kroger and Safeway. Both of those off less than a percent today. And you're listening. Wait, what's the name of the show? Oh, yeah, Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Did consumers pay more or less for stuff like food, gas, and clothing in June? The Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index. The Federal Reserve issues its monthly industrial production report. And Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke delivers the semiannual monetary policy report to members of Congress. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We had one-time Democratic strategist and present-day Democratic pundit James Carville on the broadcast last week talking about his new book and about what he thinks President Obama has to do to hang on to his job. By name, specifically, focus on the middle class. Today, the other side of the aisle, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, himself a GOP hopeful 4 years ago, talking about what Mitt Romney ought to be doing. Governor, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai. Great to be here.
What do you think of the idea that the middle class is key to who's going to win this race in November?
Well, I think the middle class is key to who's going to win the race. They're the primary people in this country right now whose future is the most uncertain. People who are in the economic underclass have government to sort of keep them from falling completely beyond the floor. People in the upper class probably have enough stashed away like squirrels with nuts in the winter that no matter what the economic conditions, they're going to land on their feet. They may have to make some adjustments, but they're not going to go to the Goodwill and get their clothing. But the people in the middle class are really losing economic empowerment. They're the ones who are working harder than they were 2 and 3 and 4 years ago, but they're not seeing more for that.
All right, so here's the corollary. Are they getting the attention they are due from the president and from Governor Romney?
Well, they're getting a lot of political rhetoric, but they're not getting the policy changes that are necessary. And when the president goes out and demonizes business and makes it as if people who have been successful and who have invested and gotten a return somehow ought to be punished for that, it just shows a complete, absolute lack of understanding of what does create opportunity for the middle class.
Come on. The president has no concept of how the economy works and how to develop things for the middle class? Come on.
Absolutely not. I mean, nobody with IQ above broccoli is out there saying that they would do better if their taxes went up and if the regulations on them got stronger.
Help me understand how a middle-class voter looks at Governor Romney and says, this is going to help me.
Well, I think the key thing they have to realize is if they had $10,000 to invest, they would have to ask themselves, if I had $10,000 and entrusted it to either Mitt Romney or Barack Obama to take care of that and get something back above my $10,000, who would I entrust it to? The guy that invested in things like Solyndra and Fisker that outsourced taxpayer jobs out of the country, or Romney, who had some failures, but he had an 80% success rate of the investments at Bain.
Well, if that's the case, sir, then why is it that the most recent ABC News Washington Post poll has Barack Obama up by 12 points on the question of who's going to do more to help the middle class, Governor Romney or the president?
I think it's a perception issue, but perception isn't reality. You know, if a person goes out there and says long enough and loud enough and often enough that I really care about you, maybe there are some people gullible enough to believe it.
But they're both doing it, sir. Come on.
Well, of course they are. But one of them has had his hands on the wheel of the vehicle, and he has not made things better. One thing that I do believe Mitt Romney's got to do, and this is an area, if I were sitting down with him, I would say, tell your story. It's a good story. But make sure that the people you talk to understand that you are not oblivious to how hard they work and how little they're getting ahead because of it.
Do you think he is doing it right now? Is it resonating, do you think?
I think there's probably some room for message improvement, but overall, I think his message—
that. Oh, come on.
No, well,
that's
just saying
great.
I'm just telling you, I think that there's always room for that. But do I think that his message is better than that of Barack Obama, who continues to blame everybody but himself? You know, every speech. I've not heard Barack Obama give a speech that didn't start with, I inherited the worst economy since the Great Depression. That's where I find that this president seems out of touch.
Last question before I let you go, sir. If he calls you up sometime in the next 10 days, 2 weeks, and says, Mike, I'd like you to run with me as my vice president, what are you going to say?
Well, I'd pick myself up off the floor since I haven't had any contact from them at all.
None at all.
It would clearly be that they have not had any interest up until that last moment. It must be that everybody else on the list had turned them down that they had fully vetted. So it would be quite a surprise if I got the call.
Governor Mike Huckabee, he's got his own radio show. If you want to hear more, it's called The Mike Huckabee Show. Governor, thanks a lot.
You bet, Kai. Good to talk to you.
Just because college students and their parents don't have enough to worry about already, there is this today. New evidence that the costs of higher education are taking their toll. A study from the student loan giant Sallie Mae that says more families are choosing less expensive schools. Even as tuitions and fees went up, families spent 5% less on college last year, and students themselves are picking up more of the tab. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland, Amy Scott has that story.
Sarah Dusich is one of the survey's authors. She says there's a misconception that families will keep on paying whatever colleges charge. But with tuition rising as family incomes decline, that's changing.
People are willing to stretch a great deal to meet the cost of college, but there is a limit to that, and they're going to send their students to schools that they can afford.
According to Sally May, more families considered cost in their college decisions last school year, and they spent 5% less on average. More than half of students saved money by living at home instead of on campus. That's up 9% from the year before, and more of them opted for community college.
Students and families are rightly concerned about rising costs.
Lauren Asher is president of the nonprofit Institute for College Access and Success. She says some of the things families do to save on college can backfire.
Going to school part-time or working long hours or going to a school that's less selective than you're qualified for can all actually reduce your chances of completion.
For 18 to 24-year-old students, parents are still footing the biggest share of the college bill. But students paid 30% last year, up from 26% the year before. Lynn O'Shaughnessy advises families on paying for college.
I think it makes children appreciate college more if they do have some responsibility to pay.
And she says most of them do. About two-thirds of students leave college with debt. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today in Santa Fe, New Mexico, organizers of the world's biggest international folk art market are counting up their take. Early guesses from this past weekend are that more than $2 million was spent on handcrafts from around the world. Bearing in mind that a single Picasso can bring something like 50 times that, perspective here is everything. But for artists from developing countries, that is a whole boatload of money, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Officials add up receipts from the Santa Fe International Folk Art Market. 56 countries were represented, ranging from Afghanistan to Zambia. The total take for rug weavers from Morocco came to
$13,546.
The response from the Moroccan women? $13,000 is big money for artists living on less than $5 a day. At the Santa Fe market, an African band set the tone as Americans shopped. This event is important because it helps replace the old traditional markets in the artists' home countries decimated by globalization. Julia Mutale represents basket weavers from the southern African nation of Zambia. She says back home, traditional baskets are still used in rural areas, but in the cities, consumers have shifted to cheaper imports.
9 times out of 10, they'll go to the department store and buy a Chinese basket.
Her husband used to run a pottery business in Zambia. Note the verb tense, used to.
When the market opened to cheap pottery from China, we couldn't compete at all. We had to close the pottery.
And it's not just Chinese imports. Cheap baskets from Vietnam, for example, have eaten into markets in the Philippines. And American mass production is also to blame. Keith Recker follows the craft market for Hand Eye magazine.
The market for used American clothing in West Africa, in many cases, particularly in menswear, has supplanted traditional garments. And to see it go away in the name of a used New York Knicks t-shirt is, for me, a negative of globalization.
When artisans get priced out of their local market by cheap imports, Recker says they're forced to adapt.
Sometimes it means taking on a job in manufacturing or taking up some other way of making a living, and we lose their skills.
Alternatively, African seamstresses can seek out new venues to sell their work abroad. American Karen Gibbs founded By Hand Consulting to help artisans link to global markets.
Those handmade textiles from West Africa now has to seek this higher value, more luxury market in order to be competitive.
Competing for customers at the market, an artisan from Malaysia plays a guitar-like instrument. Some artists are new to the Santa Fe market. Others have been coming for years. Julia Mutale has seen the impact that money made here has for basket weavers in Zambia.
It gives them economic power. They're able to send their children to school. One group even bought livestock, goats, cattle. They even bought a plow.
Over the years, profits from the Santa Fe market have funded indoor plumbing for a village in Tibet. In Ecuador, the money has paid for a roof on a women's shelter. And in Rwanda,
women have opened their own businesses through the money they get from this market.
Joy Ngute founded a Rwandan cooperative of 4,000 basket weavers. She says the money from exports has given women new status, even reducing domestic violence.
They are earning more than their men, and the husbands are now looking at their women as respectable as men.
And the Rwandan artists have tapped into other U.S. markets. For example, Macy's carries their baskets.
Everyone, including the department stores, are looking to distinguish themselves.
Marilyn Kawakami is the former president of Ralph Lauren Women's Wear. For the next year, she'll act as a mentor to an artisan from India.
For the most part, fashion here in the United States right now has been homogenized. You can find the same thing at H&M for $15 as you can see on the runways for $1,500.
She says it's the authenticity of handmade crafts and the backstory that distinguish these goods. So that same trend of globalized mass production that erodes traditional markets also makes these crafts more valued by U.S. retailers trying to stand out. In Santa Fe, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today to end where we started with Yahoo's new CEO, Marissa Mayer. We had her on the broadcast back in January of last year for what turned out to be a prescient commentary about women in technology from someone who is now one of the women in technology. Here's a little bit of what she said.
In a world where there are too few technical women, the internet serves as a powerful point of inspiration and an amazing way to tap into human creativity and potential. So, empower the geeks you know. Encourage girls. Let them know it's okay to be a geek. Daydream about mechanical engineering and how it relates to fashion. Make something thought to be science fiction a reality. Teach girls that finding your passion means that all the little details that get them excited should matter. And most of all, embrace your own inner geek.
Marissa Mayer from a commentary for us back about a year and a half ago. She is the new CEO at Yahoo, effective tomorrow, by the way. You can find the whole thing on our website. It's marketplace.org. Today, the Dow off 49 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ off 11 points, also 0.4%. The S&P 500 down 3 points, 0.25% on that particular index. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Millie Jefferson, and Megan Larson. My name's Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.